Thank you very much.
So indeed, it's a great honor and pleasure to be here. And actually, this is a story of kind of closing the circle, understanding something about which we've been wondering for many years. It's a kind of ambitious search. There are many things in quantum mechanics which make it so sharply distinct from classical physics. Superposition, non-locality, uncertainty, and so on and so on. Is there some master oddity, master mystery from which we can derive the others? Is there something about which we can say this is the fundamental thing by which quantum mechanics differs from classical physics, and then better understanding of the other oddities may come? And I suggest that it's that it is the unique status of non-events in quantum mechanics from which we should begin. There is a saying in Yiddish, if grandmother had wheels, she would be a wagon. So of course, you know, it's immaterial. She has no wheels, nothing can do about it. Well, if she is quantum mechanical, the very fact that she could have wheels can make a quantum mechanical grandmother sometimes outrace trains, police cars, and whatever. So, right? So how is it that if she's quantum mechanical, just by the possibility, the mere possibility of her having wheels, she may present us with some kinematical, surprising kinematical features. And I suggest that the analogy works very nice. It might be because grandmothers sometimes have dementia. They forget. And sometimes I want to show that quantum forgetfulness may be perhaps the key to great mysteries. So we gave it a less clinical name, Oblivion, and this is what I want to show. First, I'll begin with a very simple introduction of something that you already know by heart, but as a pedagogical tool, it's worth showing it again. I want to show you the familiar Max Zender interferometer, which we play with ad nauseum. So we know what happens. Yeah, and I want even to simplify it and turn the Max Zender into its ancient ancestor, which is the Michelson. Which is the Michelson. Bring him here. Let's make a position measurement on Yakira Haronov. It would be nice if is here, because these are some of his descendants. So you see, we know the Max Zender interferometer, but its ancestor is the Michelson interferometer, which is much simpler. It helps me to show, instead of interference, to take time symmetry or reversibility as the key for better elucidation of the uncertainty principle. So only two detectors are enough, and two mirrors in addition to beam splitter. So imagine you send a photon to these two mirrors, they reflect it back to the beam splitter, and if you didn't do any measurement, then of course it would come back to the source, to where it has been, to the side it has been emitted. Whereas, all right, so no measurement by the mirrors. However, if one of the mirrors can move and get a kick and tell you which of them absorbed the photon, then it's enough for one of them to vibrate to tell you that it has been hit by the photon, and then you get the surprise that here it's no surprise, actually, that you have disturbed the momentum. Here, position and momentum are relative. You can define them as you want, but here there are uncertainty relations about where it came from and where it goes. And of course, interaction-free measurement means that if you use only one detector, by it's just non-clicking, once again, you will get the photon failing to come to where to go back to where it came from and make this detector click. This is how I'd like to show interaction-free measurements by the very non-clicking. So here is our analogy. Grandmother could have wheels, she has none, but still by the very fact. And let's think about it for a moment. Just by the fact that the mirror is not screwed to its place, just by the fact that the bomb could explode. I mean, there is something fishy here. How could the photon tell us something about the inner working of the bomb? You know, that there are some versions of the bomb testing experiment. Some of them you just want to know whether the bomb is there. But this is the less interesting one. The more interesting one is the one in which the bomb is reflects the photon such that if the bomb can explode, then interference is destroyed, and if it cannot explode, then it reflects it, reflects back the bomb without the photon without changing interference. So this is something to think about, and in order to do that, so first of all, let me just tell you a simple idea. So we learned from Francis Bacon, knowledge is power. Along came George Orwell and said, unfortunately, sometimes ignorance is power. And what I want to show is that sometimes in quantum mechanics, maintaining ignorance gives you, due to the uncertainty principle, gives you additional power to do things which otherwise you would consider unbelievable. So here is the idea I'm proposing. You know, the story is that after we thought about after we have conceived the bomb testing experiment, then Lucian, who was doing his PhD with the late Squires, was ahead of us several times by making the effect even more and more paradoxical. What we did was to reverse the roles, the traditional roles between the photon and the detector. It was the photon telling us something about the detector in that unique setting rather than the other way around. So I guess if I can reconstruct Lucian's thought, he said the Lituanian environment got something so intriguing by reversing the role between the quantum and the classical object. What if the bomb itself is quantum mechanical? Then I'm going to get something more intriguing. And this is indeed what he has received. This is what he derived in the form of the Hardy paradox, in which an electron and positron may annihilate one another. They do not annihilate one another, but just like our grandma, so here we have grandma and grandpa, just by the fact that they could annihilate one another, you get something even more paradoxical. And several other interesting experiments, our quantum liar paradox and so on, follow this way. What we are presenting here, and this is my work with Eliyahu Cohen, is a simple case, just taking Hardy's experiment and stopping it, because beautiful things were discovered later, but if you stop it, there is something which is worth just waiting and seeing what's happening, because there might be, perhaps, the key to the intrigue. So you have, say, a positron. I've been told that PI, this is your pointer. So this is the electron, this is the positron, and you split them into two halves and also the positron, and such that you take care for the practical issues, for the technical issues, such that you are sure that if they turn out, they make interaction-free measurement on one another. The positron asks the electron, did you go on the right or on the left? And the electron is asking the positron, did you go on the right or on the left? And we took care of it that if they intersect each other's path and they turn out to reside in these intersecting paths, then they will annihilate one another and give rise to a pair of gamma photons. And we are, of course, selecting for the case in which they did not annihilate. And then something interesting is happening. So let's follow it slowly. Here we have two wave functions of the positron and the electron, not connected yet. Now they meet, And if they indeed, now the wave functions across one another, and if they turn out to meet there, of course there is annihilation and we are done with the experiment. But what if they did not? They have the chance of meeting at yet another place. So there are two possible sites in which they can meet. So the same thing may occur here. They may turn out to be, the electron may turn out to be on the left, the positron on the left, and they met at the second place. And once again, you get this not very interesting result. What, however, if you did not get annihilation in both chances, then what happens? And here, notice the unique role played by the photons in this case, the gamma photons in this case. I argue that it is even more intriguing than the normal usual interaction-free measurement, because in what we did with the bomb is the bomb tells the photon, you know what, you didn't go this way, you just went another way. What we have here is distant detectors, could be very far away, as long as you did not make any measurements on the two particles. And then some years later, or they can tell the photon, you know what, you never came here and there was no annihilation. Do you understand the temporal paradox here? That there is a photon, I can't call it virtual, the photon was, it's not a superposition of either going to the right or the left after hitting the beam splitter. It is the superposition of either having ever been emitted by the annihilation occurring or never having been emitted. That's a superposition. And many years later, another detector can decide that it never occurred. A photon that was never exchanged between two systems has a physical effect. That's something intriguing worth thinking about. So what we have here now, yeah, there are some other works that did that. Suppose that there was no annihilation, then we get something interesting. There was no annihilation at this point, no annihilation at this point. Now what do we know about the positions? We know for certain that the electron is on the left side, so it has collapsed, may I say, and that has cracked a practical... Huh?
It's on the right.
Right, did I say? Yes, on the right. So it has practical implications. If I try to do what Hardy now used to do, that is see whether it has it gives rise to interference. Interference is clearly destroyed. In other words, momentum is changed. What is interesting is about this red guy, the positron. Yeah, this was the electron. It remembers nothing of what happened, which seems to be in kind of contradiction. This time I'm not going to make an error with the year, as I did. One of them is affected, the other is not affected. That is, you see, here what I used. Momentum here is disturbed, momentum here is not disturbed, and why do I think that this interaction somehow runs counter to an important law which was discovered in 1666. So there is, I think that Newton's third law seems to be not fully respected in this case. So what we have here is that during the time interval, and now I think that we are approaching something very profound. During this time interval, there is an entanglement between the electron and the positron. Suppose that annihilation did not occur at the first opportunity, then they are now entangled. If the electron is on the left, then the positron must be on the left, and if the electron is on the right, the positron must be on the right, they are entangled. Once the critical period goes, and even at T2, there is no annihilation, there is unentanglement. Now, notice the difference. It's not disentanglement, it's unentanglement. In the ordinary EPR case, they are entangled, then we make measurement, and they are not entangled anymore. But the state is due to entanglement, which has been realized. In this case, something is reversed. One of the parties absolutely forgets about what happened, carries no trace of it, and this is why we call it quantum oblivion. Right? So we had a superposition, we had kind of entanglement. I'm trying to show how this, how the state evolves. And then some terms disappeared and leaving us with something kind of strange. Now, is this some exotic case just for fun? I argue that this is something which is ubiquitous to many measurements, because at the time we were trying to understand this, we were working also on weak measurements. And then, actually, what weak measurement is doing is refreshing our memories about something we are supposed to know all along. What do we do in strong measurement, in complete measurement? It turns out that that a very fundamental uncertainty is involved also in this kind of measurement, because what do we want to do when we want to find the position of a particle who has been split? Actually, we are looking for its momentum. We put two mirrors, but then those two mirrors are now free, such that if the photon or the particle hits a mirror, then it moves. Now something subtle follows. We want the momentum of that mirror to be very precise, in this case zero, such that we can compare the momentum before and after the moment that the particle has hit it. But that carries a price. If you want its momentum to be precise, you have to sacrifice the certainty about its position. So it goes something like that. This is weak measurement, in which the position of the mirror is precise. Therefore, its momentum is noisy, and this is how it gives weak measurement its power to do things which were before that considered impossible. So actually, what we have in an ordinary measurement is a mirror whose momentum is precise, zero, but its position is superposed. And if this is the case, I suggest that 20-something years after the discovery of the IFM, now we understand something very profound about it. For a detection to receive momentum, let me just reiterate, it must have precise momentum such that its position is uncertain, right? So this is what happens when mirror momentum gain is recorded. Its position remains unknown. Am I making this, is the visualization working? I still don't know where it is, in this case only two positions. And now we understand what happens in interaction-free measurement. And let me show you what happens. You have a critical period, critical interval, in which you refrain from doing the measurement. Do you remember that the speed of light or the speed of whatever particle by which every particle moves makes it interact with the pointer in more than one place? This is just the oblivion that we have shown. Remember the positron being in two places and the electron is interacting with it at one possible location and then the other. Now make it continuous. Many such locations, and then the particle interacts with it in one location, another location, another location. You don't want to know in which of the locations it interacted, if at all. Such that at the end, it either tells you, I have interacted with it, and here is the momentum now. There is a momentum gain, leaving the position still unknown, or it tells you it has remained in its place and leaving the position also unknown. So this makes me think again about the interaction-free measurement, and there is some satisfaction of demystifying it and now making it physical. Because let me remind you how people reacted to interaction-free measurement when the idea was first demonstrated with doing it more dramatic with a bomb. There were two positions, two extreme positions. This is why the experiment was enthusiastically embraced by two opposing traditions in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. One is the Copenhagen and its modern descendants, which is based on abandonment of any ontology. The shut up and calculate. Actually, quantum mechanics is not telling you anything about reality. It only tells you about its knowledge. So this is what Salinger loves to say. You gained information, or could gain information, about the particle's position, right? That's enough. There is no surprise that by gaining knowledge about something, you have changed it. Because in the Copenhagen interpretation, in these interpretations, there is no difference between ontology and epistemology. You know something has changed. There is no difference between the changes in your information and changes which occur really there. And the other approach is that of excess ontology. Take, for example, what Lev Weidman embraces, the many worlds. Oh, now it tells you indeed, if you want to understand it, that there are zillions of universes. And the fact that there are some, grandmother's non-existent wills exert an effect means that there are universes in which grandma has wills. And this is why in this universe, somehow she produces those mechanical unique properties of her. And I argue that what we did was to make it completely physical without any metaphysics. There was a person, Asher Peres, the late Asher Peres, who hated interaction-free measurement and always said they don't understand the problem of measurement. There was no interaction-free. There was some interaction. And it turns out that indeed every time that you test a bomb, there is a temporary, very brief entanglement between the photon and the bomb or the pointer, but then there is unentanglement. I think this is something new, and just makes it completely physical. And then it turns out that you now review several intriguing quantum mechanical experiments. It turns out that oblivion, the quantum oblivion, that phenomenon that we have just described, is what underlies them. This is what underlies the quantum Zeno effect, can be shown. Hardy's paradox, of course. In all these cases, something is happening and then unhappening during a very brief period. Quantum liar paradox. Perhaps AB, this is what Lev Weidman suggests, that something akin to oblivion occurs in this case too. Interesting to show, we believe that this is something ubiquitous that can explain several quantum mechanical oddities. Yeah, in terms of decoherence, here perhaps we have recoherence. Things which for a brief time becomes decoherent then can gain the recoherence if you do it quickly enough. What happens then? So I'm now invoking a critical interval in which you refrain from doing any measurement, and I assume that this is actually what happens, that in any quantum mechanical measurement of position, which is actually a momentum measurement, there is a brief period in which you should not complete the measurement, such that the particle interacts with all possible locations of the pointer, and only then you do it. What happens if you now completely the measurement within the interval, then of course what you get is you get incomplete measurements, such as weak measurement or partial measurement, and there is a continuum between them. If this is so, then there are some surprises, and I'm going to hand you a stack of papers to read in where these are described. Sometimes we can get, this is an idea that we received from Yakir. If you use this fact that the particle is interacting with a pointer in several in several possible places, sometimes you can get the impression that it has somehow went through the mirror as if it was a ghost, because the mirror can materialize after the particle has not failed to find it in one of its positions, then went further, and then upon further measurement, the mirror turned out to be in that position. Which, if you don't mind, I will not describe in detail here, it described in the paper. So this is the ghostly mirror. And now in what is left, I would like to indulge in some speculation. So where is the missing momentum? Here I would like to open the small discussion by you. So let me go back to the interaction I presented earlier. So we have an electron and a positron. Each of them split into two, but there is an asymmetric interaction between them. Half of the electron's wave function interacts with both halves of the positron's wave function. And then, if you remember, in cases that there was no annihilation, we see one of them affected, that is, its momentum is changing, and the other's momentum is not changing. Would anybody like to comment about what, to me, looks like a violation of momentum conservation? Do you understand the question? Then do you find it in?
I don't understand.
So let's go back to it. Good. Here we have... So, an electron, an electron is split into two, a positron is split into two. Half of this wave function of the electron interacts with two halves of the wave function of the positron. There was no annihilation in the first place, in the first possible place, then no annihilation in the second possible place. As a result, we have what looks like a collapse of the electron. It's on one side. This has physical consequences, that its momentum is disturbed. You can measure it, whereas the positron remembers nothing. Do I understand that you find nothing intriguing in this? Nothing. Do I understand that you find nothing interesting or nothing intriguing in
this? Not worry about it. But you're going to say something new now.
This is, I believe, is fairly new. So if I believe this is fairly new, because I argue that every time you make interaction-free measurements, something like this is happening. So here is what I say. Tell me if it's not new. There is entanglement, very brief, picosecond, whatever, between the particle and the bomb. Then this entanglement is undone. This makes the photon change its momentum while the bomb seems to be intact. I find this new and interesting. Anybody wants to? So Yakir thinks that there is nothing surprising in it or nothing intriguing, but would anybody else like to comment, or you agree? I see an interaction, asymmetric, between two particles, a very unique one, in which something which could have happened as a result of this interaction, that is, annihilation, did not occur. Then I see one of them change, and the other. Please do enter.
The change is really the modular momentum.
Good. Good.
Okay. And now, if you try to measure the modular momentum in the time in between, you can change the situation. The collision will happen twice or not happen at all. There is some sensitivity that maybe we shouldn't go into it now. It's also three-way.
So, first, thank you that it's not so trivial. Let me say something which is not real. Let me now say something which is not so trivial. Not everybody knows about the modular momentum. So why it is not surprising to you, it is not surprising that it is not surprising to you. But to other people who don't know what modular momentum is...
No, because when you speak about non-conservation of momentum, you only speak about non-conservation of modular momentum. If the electron is so broken of two positions, one can put it in the diagonal, then you'll change the modular momentum. And if we try to investigate that change while this observation happens, you can actually change the condition that the electron will never collide with the ball, because it makes it jump on the other side.
This is what we did with the ghostly mirror. So this is a...
Okay, I think it's too complicated to be shut now. Okay. That's interesting, okay?
Good. Any other comments? Here you have a kind of interaction in which one of the parties changes its momentum. The other, although we know that for a brief period it could change its momentum, and have we interfered, then we would see that there was an entanglement between them. But after that, one of them says to the other, you know what? You bear the consequences of this interaction. I remember nothing. There is no, and I think that you will agree with me, there is no measurement ever possible that can make the photon admit that something has happened. The oblivion is complete. Any comment?
We are talking about what could be done in the middle during the time of the oblivion.
Absolutely. We refrained from doing anything in the middle. But then look what we got. Ignorance is power. We didn't do anything, and then we got this this intriguing case in which two particles may have interacted. Have they interacted? But due to the possibility of their interaction, one of them is radically changed. It will fail to return to its the place where it came from. So its momentum is changed. And the other, if anybody can show me any measurement now that they can do in order to make the electron admit that it has anything to do with this interaction, that there is any trace of it, there is none. I find this very interesting, and I find that this goes and in order to understand now intriguing phenomena like the IFM or Hardy paradox or the Liar paradox, we should think about such cases. That is that beneath the quantum level, there is, I wouldn't call it sub-quantum because it's still quantum, but we don't think about it. There are very brief periods of time in which things happen and then unhappen.
Sure.
But absolutely. But in usual, in laboratories, usually this is very brief. Yeah, Gedanken, and this is what we are doing. Gedanken, we can expand them and then get interesting results.
I'm just trying to extract the sense in which this is quantum. So in the classical case, you could have two particles, which if they collide, they explode to bond.
Recoil.
Let's make it dramatic, like you can trace. They're bonds, and if they collide, they explode. Otherwise, so you could have them put into a classical mixture of going along these two directions, and if you see no explosion,
then measure the momentum.
Then you know statistically that the plus bond has the same statistics as it had before, completely oblivious to the presence of the bond.
Whereas the minus bond has
had its statistics changed.
Yeah, but the minus bond is—it's not statistic anymore. It's now—it's unity.
Yeah, right.
You are sure that it went to the other way. So first of all, it's not statistical. Second of all, its momentum has changed. Try to time reverse it, and it remembers, and it fails to go back to where it came from. I don't know. I love it.
In the classical case, you don't have like single run properties that change, I suppose. Whereas in the quantum space, you do have single. What is it this thing?
Do you think that will explain it? What do you mean? Sometimes it's a
I'm not trying to explain, I'm just trying to understand
okay.
the sense
yeah,
in which
sure.
this is a quantum rather than classical effect.
Oh, yes. Show me a classical analog to this, that due to a possible interaction that actually we know that did not occur, they did not explode, one of them, its momentum is changed, and the other shows no trace of this effect that it has exerted on the other. Plus, the other thing is that we have here, and this is what I find so intriguing, it means that we have here a third partner or a fourth partner, two more partners or pairs of partners, and these are the powerful gamma photons. We had gamma photons here who could have been emitted. The two detectors could be far away on some distant star. They played a role, a causal role, in what happened here. we wait long enough to see whether they clicked, if they are far away, and we refrain from doing any measurement. And then they did not click, both of them. This is more than interaction frame measurement. It's not a photon that could go here or here. It's a photon that could have been emitted many years ago, come to the detector and be absorbed, and now it turns out that it did not come. But the fact that it did not come is a causal effect exerted by the distant detector. Do you find this also not intriguing, Yakir, may I ask?
Yes.
Okay. I guess modular momentum will again be the key, or do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, because the decision before the main out or not is decided at the minute when it's created. You don't have to detect it later. You got the minute when the electron goes there and it tests possibly state of the proton, there is now a superposition of two situations. One, there is a photon, the other is not. The one that there is a photon, you don't have to wait for electron detecting it. It's already there.
Let me show a case in which strains your interpretation, and it goes like this. So this is the Lyra paradox all over again. We have an excited atom. Can everybody see?
This is not a good show.
Can you use white chalk?
Right.
Otherwise, it will be an undetected photon.
Thank you, Yasir. Thank you very much. Okay. Excited atom?
Yes.
Now, there is a cavity.
What?
A cavity.
Okay.
So this cavity makes sure that it emits a photon, it will eventually...
No, make sure also that the photon will come to the other side.
What?
You have got again.
It is reflecting walls. Reflecting. Okay. The walls are reflecting.
Reflecting. So it will be emitted and be absorbed, and emitted and be absorbed many times. Okay. But all right. No, the cavity... They can mention the light and I hope if you have the other.
Okay.
But
you agree that we can take care of it somehow?
I don't see why we need the cavity. You just have a free echo and then it decays to space and wait.
Very good.
Detectors everywhere. Why do you have to?
Very good. Very good. Okay.
Have a free echo. Free echo.
Yeah, but then
free
I need.
Excited. And you can miss the first one in any direction. You have detectors all over the place that could detect the.
Wonderful.
Why do you mean?
So I have
your design experiment, you can put as many detectors in space. So don't worry about the
I'm doing it. Ground atoms. And there are many like that. But
now two atoms?
Yeah, as you say there are many, but I'll consider this one.
Okay.
This is why I wanted the cavity. Okay, just to make sure. So there is a ground atom.
Oh, you have an atom there, yes.
And
by the way, if the wavelength emitted by the proton is very low compared to the distance, the second atom will definitely absorb with probability 1/2 the proton.
Thank you. I'll take care of that. I'll take care of that.
Oh, you can. Good for you. Yeah. Okay, gentlemen. So
you know that after a certain time, t tau,
yes,
it will emit a photon. This
happened.
Right.
If so the light is T, after T,
tau.
Probability 1/2 or 1/3, 1/2 squared, it's in the
right.
So,
right.
Okay. Yeah.
So would you agree that after tau, half tau, there is 50% now that it is ground and 50% that it is excited?
Yes.
Good. Now there is this distance between them. And time the speed of light, time and the time it takes for it to pass the distance between them, times the speed of light. So now this is in a superposition of being excited or ground.
But we don't need a second atom. We have a superposition between an atom that is excited and no photon, and an atom is a ground that is a photon. They just do the entanglement. Why do we need that?
Just let me do one more complication and then things, I promise you, will be smooth from then on. So after a while, this is in a superposition of excited and ground. And I wait long enough to see that no photon is still on its way. Here, I can take care of this, take out this. Do you agree with me that now these two are entangled? If this is ground, this is excited. If this is excited, this is ground. You prepare many pairs like that and give them to Alice and Bob. Would you agree with me that Bell inequality violations can be found in this case too? You look for some orthogonal measurements to excited and ground, such as magnetic momentum, and both of them, having received many such pairs, make the measurements by free choice. At the last moment, they decide, this time I'm going to measure whether it is excited or ground. This time I'm going to measure its magnetic moment. Write down all the lists, and just as Bell promised us, when they meet, they find out. They conclude, and here again is another counterfactual. Had Alice chosen to measure here excited or ground, then I would get another magnetic moment. Have Alice chosen to measure magnetic moment, I would get excited or instead of ground and ground instead of excited. Tell me whether I did anything wrong so far, because this is extremely important. This is what Bell's inequality tells us, that there is some non-local thing going on because we gave free choice to Alice and Bob. No objections to that? Okay, now. Would you agree with me, because they have two measurements that they have to choose randomly, that in half of the cases, Bob would measure excited versus ground, as well as Alice. Fine? Would you agree with me that in half of these cases, 25%, he will get that this is ground, and she will get that this is excited, whether overlapping or not? There is something strange here, because if this is excited, that means that no photon ever was emitted. Just if I try to make sense, as Yakir says, give me a story of what happened here. The story is I began with an excited atom, and it's still excited. And in those cases in which Alice, by chance, chose also to measure whether it's excited or ground, you're sure that it will be ground. That means that they are not entangled. But the fact that they are not entangled is due to entanglement. Imagine policemen going to Lucien Hardy's home and say, we have a warrant against him. And his wife says, Lucien says he is not at home. Do you think that there is something inconsistent in what Mrs. Hardy tells the police? And do you agree that this is the situation here? Yakir, Do you find that in this case, a photon that could have been exchanged, if I try to follow you and tell a story, I can't make a reasonable story here. Do you agree?
I'm worried about the fact that if you look at the photon comes to the other atom, you can say that I have an entanglement between the atom and the photon. So if the atom is excited, there is no photon. If the atom is in the ground, there is photon. But if the atom is in a superposition of being excited like ground, then the superposition of being a photon and no photon, then the superposition of photon and vacuum, which is orthogonal to the other possibility of a different position of photon and vacuum. So we are involved here also with the number of particles that are unconserved. So that makes the thing more subtle. So I have to think more about your witness. It's true that finally, when the photon is blocked by the atom, you can say that it must have come from the first atom if you didn't do any experiment on the photon in the middle. Because if you didn't experiment the photon in the middle to check whether it is a superposition of excited and vacuum, then the two atoms could be excited.
How about waiting long enough such that, you know, that if photon has been, suppose that the half-life of this atom is...
If you wait long enough, there is a possibility that the atom was emitted from one atom, the photon was emitted from one atom, went to the other atom, and then came back to this atom. And then you will have a situation where there is a ground there, although in the middle there was a proton.
Thank you. So, do you think that we can take care of this eventually if we work hard?
I think that it comes to such a thing when you consider entanglement between atom and proton.
Right.
Because the number of protons is not observed. Some experiments will produce protons. And therefore, there is a possibility that you have to worry about the possibility that the proton went to the atom.
Here is what I do in a minute.
If you are sure that it's not going in the middle, then it means that you have to wait times longer than 2L over C, and then you are not sure that if you found it, and this is of a size, that other one was the right size. So it's not very subtle.
But can we overcome these subtleties, or these are subtleties?
I think it will take too long to discuss about all these subtleties. So
okay.
It's interesting. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, Baba.
And the thing that worries me here is you have two atoms and they have an interaction with each other, even
right.
Though it's very weak. So as soon as you separate them, you change the interaction. So you also do something with the vacuum. So
that's, yeah,
so
that would be an additional subtlety.
Not changing the situation.
Yeah, yesterday when I spoke with Baba, I tried to anticipate such an objection and say, bring them close. Such that this distance will not make a difference. Then seal them and then take them apart.
You do what?
Seal them in their cavities. You didn't like the cavities, but this is why I want.
You cut.
Right.
Yeah, but then you also destroy
the
electron
detection.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So
you
can
yeah, this is why I wanted this kind of cavity, such that the door is smeared by some detective material. And you
I think
from.
You may be right.
Okay.
So I don't want to argue against it.
Thank you.
But
okay.
I think there is some.
Okay.
Some type of thing here that has to be.
Absolutely.
To be absolutely
so
clear.
Right.
Is it clear that in some percentage of the cases, you can sort of argue that there was no photon transmitted from one side to the other? But still, to actually violate the Bell inequality, you need to consider all the other cases as well. And so in some of those cases, there must have been a photon, or at least there is uncertainty about whether there was.
That's very important, Lucien. I beg to differ. Let's see. Because if you're correct, then this really weakens it considerably. I think that by selecting out for the cases in which the photon was on its way, this is preparation, and this is completely legitimate. And then I present Alison Bob with pairs of post-selected atoms.
Okay.
Then I see nothing. Tell me if I'm wrong.
So you
I don't think that the part which I
have you post-selected
I wait long enough. Say I place a detector next to one of them, next to the ground one. Wait long enough, and there was no click. Then I eliminate the case in which there was still a photon on its way.
Okay, but now those two. Atoms are not entangled.
Yeah, they are entangled. Wait, I waited for the time in which it takes for the photon to reach from one place to another. Then, for the possibility that it's still on the way, this I can eliminate. I argue that, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the pairs of atoms which I give to Alice and Bob are EPR for all practical matters. They don't differ from any pairs of entangled particles. This is a kind of preparation that you just clean, and then you say these are entangled. Except,
your detector is just detecting see if there's still a photon in transit.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So if there is no photon still in transit, then sure the two atoms are entangled. But you were interested in the case where no photon traveled at all.
So here's what you do.
That's only a fraction of the other
people. One quarter, more than one quarter. Alice chooses between two measurements, excited ground and magnetic moment. And so both. They do not overlap, so it's more, she has 25% and he has 25%, and because they do not overlap, now you have a sizable case of experiment in which one of the atoms retained its original position, then actually telling you, if you try to make a story, that no interaction has occurred. In some cases, there are two atoms which has retained their position. So the story is clear. This has been excited, remained excited. This has been ground, remained ground. You can't take them out from the entire ensemble. Bell's inequality violation is based on the entire ensemble.
Right.
Some people try to say the following, that don't bring this into account, which reminds me of the case of three people caught by a policeman playing poker, and then he wants to find them, so he goes to the first guy and says, what do you think you are doing? So he says, I was just looking and give him some bribe. Then he goes to the other and says, and what are you doing? And he says, no, I was just looking also. So he gives him some bribe. Then he goes to the third and says, and what have you been doing? And he says, why are you doing it like this? If this guy's been looking and I've been looking, what do you think, with whom do you think I play? You can't take them out. Do you agree with me that you can't say that you don't
want to see it? The reason why I suspect that it's not as good as you say, if I'm giving two speed, and I'm told that the time taken to build spin one goes up and spin the other goes down, that information is given. Now I want to produce by measurement APR state. That measurement must necessarily extract this information from the cluster. Any interaction that we produce with APR will destroy this cluster. Now you come with this different story. The fact that I can know that one level is up and the other one is down, and without eliminating this pass, I create a full EPR. So this story seems to be inconsistent with what can be done by using interaction between speed. So either we found there is some new way of making interaction between two speeds that will not erase the pass. Oh, this is not equivalent to dilute EPR. Okay, now, that I find extremely interesting, but that's why I'm looking for a whole here. Because usually I know that if I have two speeds, and I know that initially one is up and the other is down in the direction, then I come and produce a Bell state by some measurement that necessarily must erase this path, erase all the memory. Now you come here with a new story. If you say, I have two spins, one up and one down, that is calculated and down and so on, and I waste some time and nature produce for me an exact Bell state without erasing the information in the past. They seem to be against all the things that I know that can be done with two spins. So either there is something that is missing here and that is not completely Bell state, all the past is going to be erased because the person could go many times back, or you have discovered a completely new way to find an interaction between two things that could produce a Bell state without erasing the past. So it's not just a question of puzzlement, it's finding a new kind of interaction in nature. Okay, you understand this is a very big responsibility on your shoulder to say, look, I discovered a new way to couple two spin half, they got to complete Bell state, they got to erase the past. Because any user interaction I will do to make them in their Bell state will automatically erase this path. So it's very interesting either way. One way that you found a new way to produce Bell state between two spin half without erasing the path is fantastic. The other way that you can't do it, then you have to find what is the mistake in what you're doing. Okay? I intuitively, I feel that that's the second thing is the answer. Because I don't believe that you could find something completely new about interaction between two spin up. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm not
no.
Sure.
Let me try to clarify.
Okay. Let me explain because it seems very important. Look, if I have two speed, one, and I know initially the one is up and the other is down. That's why I give two atoms, one excited, one is down. Now I come and go to introduce a measurement, some interaction between the two, at the end of this interaction will be a Bell state, up, down, goes down, up. Okay?
Okay.
Sigma.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I come to this spin that I know initially one is up and the other down. I make the usual coupling that measures sigma dot sigma, and it produces completely Bell state. I can prove now that that interaction must erase all the memory of what was the state in the past. He now comes with an idea that he has a spin up and spin down. He waits for a while, produce a complete bell state without erasing the past. So this would be something completely novel if you can do this. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. You have to think about it. I think
Please stay. I want to just show another version of this, which may solve the problem. I know you're in a hurry, but just could you just consider this one?
Yes.
So because there is an older version of the quantum liar paradox, and see whether it is immune to this concern that you mentioned. So I'll do it very quickly. This time I do have two cavities, which is, I guess, okay. Two atoms. No, okay, no cavities. Two atoms.
The central atoms and neurons.
And neurons. Two of them are excited.
Yeah.
And there is a time in which they are supposed to emit a photon.
Say it again?
There is a tau.
One of them is excited, the other is not.
No, both of them are excited.
Ah, both of them are excited.
Very good. Now I place a half silver mirror here, a big beam splitter. A beam splitter?
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
And I assume that the photon will be emitted through this way. Here I put two detectors.
Yeah.
I post select for the cases in which I have one click in one of them. In this case, again, I'm ignorant whether this has contributed
and
this.
It's only one photon on the meter.
Right.
Okay, you do an experiment and you notice the.
And then I found that they are Bell.
Yeah.
Are they Bell now? Are they entangled now? Are they EPR?
Yeah.
Now I do the same thing. Either Alice and Bob.
Again, I have to worry about the same certificate in the other.
But this is how the entangled state in the Delft experiment is prepared.
Good. So in this case, I can also show you cases in which apparently one of them did not contribute any photon. So then it is not entangled. But once again, this unentanglement is due to entanglement, and I have the liar paradox all over again.
Let me say that you raise a very interesting question. Either you can do something with the two atoms that you can't do with normal two spins, because in the middle there was intervention of either the geophysics of the photon that can be born and then unborn.
Born and unborn, I love it, yeah.
Yeah.
A photon that could be born and unborn.
Yeah, okay. Or because of this situation, just a producer gets a bell state because it did not generate the power. Okay, so because then it will be something that can be done in this new way, it can be finally done just with two spin half. So two spin half, I can't ever produce a bell state by interaction that doesn't erase completely the past. Okay.
Thank you very much. Please stay for one moment. I'll make a closing remark. But thank you, Yekir, for attending. What I want to say is, now think about the universe. There is something to think about, because it turns out that most of the interactions that we have in the universe are of the interaction free kind. Most of the interactions in the universe are of this kind. By now we are bombarded with zillions of wave functions of photons which went spherically to all directions, and then they encounter several possible absorbers and they just vanish from that place. So it's interesting, I don't know how many people thought about it, that most of the interactions. Yes, Barbara.
Yeah. I've been wondering for some time about this question. What
right.
is this lonely photon?
Right, and moreover, many interactions are of the born-unborn kind. Think about a faraway radioactive atom, and there is an alpha particle, beta, gamma, or something like that. Also, wave function going to all directions, and we don't know when it will be emitted, when that particle will be emitted. By us here, not detecting any particle from that, we are making measurement on that very distant atom. So that we could again create Bell inequality violations, if I'm correct, between them. That's something interesting. So much is happening in the universe, so many unevents, so many particles that could have been emitted and not emitted, and they still exert some causal effect. The implications for this for thermodynamics, for statistical mechanics, even for Mach's principle, are quite far-reaching, wouldn't you say? Please beneath the ordinary quantum levels that we see with our measurements, the world is full with such conditional particles who between themselves may do other things. There is a layer of reality there, a bit reminiscent of the many worlds, but not in our universe, which may happen, still does not happen, and still plays a role in the wonderful drama, kind of mysterious drama around us. I hope that we made one step further in understanding what this drama, this tip of the iceberg. Thank you very much.
So you asked the question where the momentum goes. So isn't it that the electron gets entangled with the beam splitter?
Sure.
And then the beam splitter takes all the momentum and then
it becomes entangled, but this is important, and then becomes unentangled.
Yes.
Not disentangled, but unentangled. This is, you are absolutely correct.
But the beam splitter carries the momentum. So
it is only because of the greater time resolution that we employed here that we understand what is happening here. And then I argue that this is what happens also when the bomb does not explode. For a while, the sensor of the bomb fills the photon, and it may turn to a full explosion, but then the photon still marches to other parts of the wave function, and then the result of that is that there is no position measurement, and therefore momentum now has a choice to be either zero or one. So actually, what we are saying here, we are demystifying IFM, no need in Copenhagen or many worlds or something like that. Something physical is happening, and then unhappening, which is very interesting. And weak measurements and other such subtle measurements are happening here. So I find this something nice by you showing a continuum between ordinary measurements and other incomplete measurements. Thank you very much again. Bye.